This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Domestic violence cases are up, way up, possibly because the pandemic makes everyone feel a little lost.
I think that leads offenders to be more likely to try to regain that feeling of power and control by dominating their intimate partners and their children and abusing them.
And family violence incidents are getting more serious in McLean County, too. Plus, an epidemiologist says schools like Illinois State University that don't have clear guidelines on when to shut down or take interim steps are running a risk. A Bloomington candy maker takes steps to prevent or limit COVID-19. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner talks about buying marijuana on Veterans Parkway. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says he wants the state government to prepare for 5% cuts across the board. That's because he's not sure whether Congress will pass another stimulus bill related to losses from the pandemic. Pritzker called the estimated $6.5 billion in losses over the course of the pandemic a nightmare scenario and blames Republicans for not approving a measure to help state governments.
The GOP leadership's decision to support big businesses but not support working families has reached a critical point.
In addition, Pritzker's administration is preparing for 10% cuts for the next fiscal year. The governor says he's not sure when he would institute the most immediate cuts because it depends on what Congress does. McLean County Board Member Carlo Robustelli is resigning at the end of the month. Robustelli was not running for a new term anyway, but a new job forced the early resignation. Robustelli represents District 8, which covers downtown Bloomington and parts of the West Side. Democrat Leah Klein and Republican Jordan Baker are running for that seat. Robustelli has been a fundraiser at Illinois Wesleyan University and will become vice president for advancement at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. At Eureka College, the fall semester is going so far so good, so says college president Jamel Wright.
Our positivity rate is right at 1%, and that dates all the way back from the start of the pandemic. So we're talking about a total of about 21 cases so far, and that's a combination of students and employees.
Wright says mitigation is easier on a small college campus like Eureka. Dorm rooms are single student, and Eureka has made auditoriums into classrooms to keep students farther apart. Wright says enrollment is up 9%, and the college's financial situation is solid enough to weather the COVID-19 pandemic without major cuts. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, WGLT, and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. During the pandemic, those on the front lines of domestic violence in Bloomington Normal say they have seen an alarming increase in not just the number of incidents, but also the severity. Ryan Denham has the story.
The numbers are stark. From March to July of 2019, about 215 new domestic violence cases were filed in McLean County Court. During that same time this year, it's more than tripled. Here's Mary Cole, the McLean County prosecutor who handles felony domestic violence in the state's attorney's office.
My caseload is really stacked with very serious cases right now in a way that it hasn't been since I came to McLean County several years ago.
Cole has seen an increase in severe cases like broken bones, lacerations, brain injuries. She's also seen more strangulations. That's a particularly dangerous type of domestic violence because some believe it's a significant predictor for future lethal violence. There have also been more reports coming in from Bloomington Normal hospitals. That's according to Sena Ajabang, director of Countering Domestic Violence.
So we might have 5 incidents, but it felt like 10 because of just the severity of it. And that's when you get really nervous because people can die or be very severe. And if we have an increase in reporting from the hospital, right, then you know that people, although there's a pandemic, they didn't have a choice but go to the hospital because of the severity of the abuse.
Domestic violence holds an unusual status in the criminal justice system, in that it's so common that it doesn't attract much public or media attention when it happens. For the Bloomington Police Department, domestic reports are the most frequent call for service that officers respond to.
It's up substantially.
That's Jeff Engel, one of two Bloomington police detectives assigned to domestic violence cases. His department responded to about 679 domestic-related calls for service between April and July of this year. That's up 28% from a year ago.
It doesn't appear like it's going to slow down anytime soon, and I'm going to assume it's just because of the COVID. Everybody's around each other a lot more than they normally be.
Well, it's hard to draw a straight line between the pandemic and any individual act of domestic violence. Advocates and those in law enforcement say there's some correlation. COVID has amplified many of life's stressors, such as job or income loss, the inability to pay rent or utilities, and it's layered on new ones, like being stuck at home together more often or without childcare because the schools are closed. More people are self-medicating with alcohol or drugs, and together that's a recipe for an increase in domestic violence. Prosecutor Mary Cole says, like the rest of us, offenders are feeling a loss of control over their own lives right now.
I think that leads offenders to be more likely to try to regain that feeling of power and control by dominating their intimate partners and their children and abusing them.
Sena Ajabang with Countering Domestic Violence says some offenders have deliberately weaponized the pandemic.
The dynamic of an offender is to find vulnerabilities. And if you don't have any, you don't feel like you have anywhere to go, or you don't have a job at that time, you're laid off, they will capitalize on that. Nobody's going to help you. There's nothing out there, so you need to stay here.
Cole says some victims are more isolated than ever.
If they're working from home, you know, they don't have their safety net of their coworkers and even their HR people who can help them get hooked up with resources or church, etc.
She says another troubling COVID-related trend is that there are more repeat offenders while they're out on bond. She says offenders with limited housing options are more likely to return to their victim's residence, which would typically be a violation of the terms of their bond.
We are seeing people violating that no contact order over and over. So it's not uncommon right now to have someone who has a pending domestic battery case and then two or three pending violation of bail bond cases for violating that no contact order, and then a lot of violation of order of protection cases as well.
Sena Ajabang with Countering Domestic Violence praised judges and courthouse staff for staying accessible to grant orders of protection throughout the pandemic. One change that's made it slightly easier to obtain emergency orders of protection is that victims can now file the paperwork electronically and then appear in front of a judge by phone. That's according to Will Scanlon, trial court administrator for the 11th Judicial Circuit. That includes McLean County.
We had been trending around 650 orders of protection annually. I suspect we'll be up 10 or 20% and maybe more.
Those who commit domestic violence often end up in court-ordered treatment in programs such as Chestnut Health System's Invitation to Responsibility, or ITR. Carrie Anderson is Chestnut's Associate Director of Outpatient Services. She says treatment comes later in the process, so they're only now starting to see an uptick in clients.
I don't think we've yet had somebody say, well, it's the pandemic's fault that I did this, but it is fairly common for folks, especially at the beginning of the process, to blame other people or other situations for why they're in the situation they've gotten arrested or whatever it may be. And so that is definitely something we address always in treatment, is what can they control? And it's their own behaviors that they can control.
Bloomington Police Detective Jeff Engel says offenders tend to blame their substance abuse problem.
It is definitely a problem. It's a disease that needs to be taken care of. But in my mind, there's nothing that you can say or do that's going to make it right. And so it's your actions, and you knew what you're doing. It's just you need to learn.
Everyone interviewed for this story stressed that help is available if you're experiencing domestic violence. It's not shut down. The Countering Domestic Violence 24/7 hotline is 309-827-7070. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can see an interactive graphic showing trends in domestic violence pre- and post-COVID at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a look at a Bloomington candy maker and what they're doing to reduce the spread of the virus. It's been 9 months since cannabis became legal in Illinois, and now Bloomington will get its first dispensary. Jushi already runs a store in North Normal. Its second local store will be in Bloomington along Veterans Parkway. Ryan Denham speaks with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner about the City Council's sign-off last night of that plan and the latest on COVID-19 enforcement.
Well, I think it's a positive step, and I certainly supported the legalization of cannabis. I think the long kind of fixation that the federal government has had in being anti-cannabis has not been helpful. And certainly a lot of people are still in prison for things that really would not be illegal at all today. But in terms of the economic benefits, I think it's certainly be an economic benefit, new revenue for the city of Bloomington, definitely at a time during COVID where we certainly could use everything that we can.
I believe the city's going to be taxing cannabis sales at 3%. Do you have any sense of how much tax revenue this place could bring in?
We've certainly got quite a few estimates depending on how much was sold, but we really don't know how much will be sold in that site as opposed to the one perhaps in Normal.
Back in December when the council decided to allow cannabis dispensaries and, you know, set up all the zoning stuff, at that time, council members decided against allowing on-site consumption, so no cannabis cafes. You know, we're 9 months into this thing now. Do you think that will ever happen, and do you want it to?
I do, and I think it will. I think we all know how this plays out. It's just a question of how many years it takes before that becomes acceptable. People who were concerned that the legalization of cannabis would allow Rome to fall, I think are probably going to realize that that's not happened. It hasn't happened so far. It won't. Our main goal or main concern right now is obviously COVID. And so I'm glad that the marijuana dispensary is opening. I think over time, you know, you'll probably have a situation where you could buy this kind of stuff at your friendly neighborhood grocery store.
Mayor Terry Renner, let's switch over to COVID-19. Over Labor Day weekend, the Bloomington Police Department did compliance checks at bars, found three in violation and only one that didn't address those violations, allegedly Cadillac Jack's. So they're now facing three liquor license violations. What was your reaction to Cadillac Jack's and how it allegedly handled COVID precautions?
Well, because I'm going to have to judge the case, I don't want to make any kind of comments that might indicate that I've prejudged it, and I haven't. I know what our police officers have said. I've seen the evidence, but I have not talked to Mr. Bentley, who's the owner of Cadillac Jack's, directly or his attorney. But at this point, this is part of a several-week attempt to really aggressively enforce our COVID restrictions and requirements. And in most cases, when our police are engaged in a so-called crackdown or an aggressive enforcement, what they're doing is constantly reminding people to please exercise caution or put on a mask, or there's too many people that are congregated together. There are dangers of COVID spreading. So that's one of the things that we've been trying to do to help stabilize the numbers. And it takes a few weeks, of course, under these circumstances to see whether or not your efforts are having some success. I think that they are.
You mentioned Mr. Bentley. William Bentley is the owner of Cadillac Jack's. He has hired attorney Tom DeVore to represent him. And DeVore is well known because he has sued in opposition to all sorts of COVID precautions all around the state. Do you expect the city of Bloomington to get sued or for this to get wrapped up into other DeVore litigation that he's already filed related to businesses?
Well, I certainly hope not. But if that's the case, we will protect public safety. That's our number one goal. And we have to be on top of enforcing COVID restrictions. But I certainly hope that we don't get into a legal battle over this. I hope common sense will prevail.
Is Cadillac Jack's at risk of losing its license?
Well, again, I can't comment on that. That is one of the possibilities for violations. There could be a fine, and the fines start at $250 on up per count if found guilty. It also could include suspension of a liquor license or revocation of a liquor license. The revocation would have to be something that was consistent and systematic and really pretty extreme.
One last COVID-related matter. The city has launched a COVID small business assistance grant program, and applications are now open for that. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, now we're very, very excited about that, very proud of it. I'm glad that the council was supportive of this. I certainly, Mr. Gleason and I and Melissa Hahn, the head of the Economic Development Department, have been talking about this for quite some time. Small businesses can go online to our cityblm.org website, and they can apply online. And it's up to $4,500 for small businesses. The money would go toward costs that have been incurred because of having to adapt to COVID. So it might be additional social distancing or maybe opening up to the outside. There may be situations of particular businesses had to shut down because they've had an employee or perhaps in two that have tested positive. So there are a variety of criteria, but it is up to $4,500 per business. And I would certainly encourage all of our small businesses that think that they're eligible to apply.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner speaking with Ryan Denham. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Coos. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, how to gauge whether a college campus is doing okay in limiting the spread of the virus. That story in just a few minutes. A Bloomington manufacturer has opened a temporary COVID-19 testing site that is open to the public. The Illinois Department of Public Health is paying for the testing at Ferrero USA in southwest Bloomington through Thursday. Ferrero makes dozens of chocolate and candy brands, including Butterfinger, Baby Ruth, and Nutella. Ferrero's Senior Vice President of North American Operations, Pasquale Giorgio, tells Eric Stock the testing is voluntary for Ferrero employees. The Bloomington plant has had three coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. It has about 350 workers. Giorgio says even though there's enough COVID testing capacity in Bloomington Normal, the company wants to be proactive to contain the virus.
It was more to bring here, you know, to have the people more aware of the possibility to prevent. And it was just in order to encourage the people to be more active in fight the COVID.
3 days, not a tremendous amount of time for something that's been going on for months and could go on for many more. How much of an impact do you expect this to make, and might this come back again later?
So we'll see how it's going, and then we will decide what to do. So far, the factory is really managing very well with social distances, with all the barriers, with several other activities, and this is just more to have the people involved and to have 100% of the people aware of what is going on.
Social distancing is not always easily done at a manufacturing environment. So what kind of protocols has Ferrero put in place here?
Okay, we have several activities. I can just mention some, but don't consider that holistic. So we have the mask is mandatory every time. We have the screen where the people could be accidentally in closer than 6 feet. We do have the shift staggering shifts. We change the layout of the canteen to be sure that there are only one person per table. We reinforce the cleaning and the usage of suitable chemicals for sanitation. There are several orders and the policy in terms of travel, the restricted travel manager. I mean, no one is flying anymore since March, just to give you an example. Only drive one person per car. You know, all this kind of activity that help to prevent. And so far, the situation is quite good. It's very under control. We had only few cases, all related with people that during the holidays they travel in some area, but they are being isolated immediately and quarantined, so didn't have too much effect on the factory.
How much of an adjustment has it been for the employees to have that additional awareness, that additional layer of protection while doing their job on a daily basis?
Very good reaction. Initially, of course, everyone was concerned, but then we saw that the people realized that the measures were very good. Some people say, well, I feel safer here than home. That's a good statement. And so far, I mean, the situation is managed relatively well for the people. So the people perceive that there is a little bit more difficult time for everyone. So having the mask for 8 hours is heavy, but the people understand it is needed.
I wonder how sales are going at a time where people are turning to comfort foods, candy, chocolates, those are comfort. Has there been a market movement there?
It's okay. I mean, I cannot say it's booming, but fortunately it's not collapsing. So far there is variability. It's more unpredictable than the past. But so far the business is relatively stable.
So I guess the economic concerns are probably counterbalancing the increased demand, possibly?
It's really balanced. I mean, there is no huge, you know, we are in the food industry in a very specific sector. But overall, we cannot complain that the situation is it's good. So we feel that regardless of the time, so the people have managed to keep the business running safe for themselves and safe for the product. That's the important part.
That's Pasquale Giorgio from Ferrero with Eric Stock. Giorgio says the pandemic has slowed the company's Bloomington plant expansion, though he says some renovations have begun. The company previously said it plans to hire up to 50 workers. Several taxing bodies, including Bloomington and McLean County, have approved economic incentives for the projected $70 million expansion. This is Sound Ideas. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Comparing college campus COVID-19 numbers can be tricky because of a variety of approaches to testing and reporting data. A lot of Midwestern college campuses bear watching, though. Brian Chen is a public health professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield, who does that. Speaking with WGLT's Dana Vollmer, Chen defines what he considers a successful COVID-19 mitigation strategy.
I think the ultimate goal for a successful mitigation of COVID-19 is that all infected people or students can be properly treated, isolated, and quarantined until they have two consecutive PCR tests within 24 hours with the negative results, which means that we have a concrete evidence that there will be no harm to the community. It's sort of a dynamic to reach that ultimate goal. With that being said, I'd like to mention the few key points from my personal opinion that what would be a successful mitigation to reach that ultimate goal that I have mentioned. So one would be data-driven early detection of the infection situation on campus. The second would be some proper penalty is related with money, or some students, they may be suspended for their contract in Greek House. The third I would put is that good timing to decide either to take a pause or to go fully remote for the rest of the entire fall 2020 semester.
When we talk about a successful campus reopening, is the most successful university necessarily the one with the lowest number of confirmed cases?
I don't think it's just like gymnastics in Olympics, that the fewer cases could consider the number one. I mean, if we only look at the numbers, I don't think it's fair to for those universities with a larger population and with a more crowded situation. We probably can separate to compare the campuses with the similar level of the threats that would make more sense to me. Generally speaking, it will be challenging to generate a universal sort of scoring like a leaderboard of how successful the campuses are.
Are the universities that were leading in confirmed COVID-19 cases early in the semester likely to continue to be the troubled campuses?
Let me say this. The stage right now is probably just the beginning of the game. Some of the schools take less rigorous effort, and then who knows, eventually they end up with how many cases and the we don't know at this point. So some of the schools, they already had 10% of infected students or the people, but they still stay the same sort of policy for those in-person classes. So we probably, it would take like more 10 weeks or 12 weeks or the end of this fall semester. Then we will probably have a better idea that, okay, this strategy worked and that strategy didn't work.
So if we just have to kind of wait and see, how should universities be approaching COVID-19 in the meantime?
If we don't know the enough about the virus, why not just go for stricter sort of policies? But I understand that it would be really challenging for some large universities because it's just so many money, resources involving in that. And it's really challenging to sort of come up with a concrete prediction model that which way is the best way to use the money or to use the prevention strategy to have the best results.
That's University of Illinois Springfield Public Health Professor Brian Chen talking to WGLT's Dana Fulmer. Chen says he's concerned universities like Illinois State that haven't defined criteria for when to scale back operations are playing a dangerous waiting game. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.